Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Dr. Laurie Santos, host of the Happiness Lab podcast. It's never too late or too early to learn how to feel happier. So my new season has well-being tips for you, whether you're aged 3 or 103.
Or 6, like me.
Did I mention I have some amazing co-hosts for this season?
And do not forget cute and furry.
How could I, Grover? I'll be joined by my fabulous friends from Sesame Street.
That's us.
Hello, everybody!
Friends.
Be sure to listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, I am so excited.
This is going to be so magical.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 16th of September, these are our main stories. The BBC reaches Libya's city of Derna after the deadly floods and finds international aid agencies are yet to arrive in force. President Macron says the French ambassador to Niger is being held hostage at the embassy in Niamey. And the former president of Spanish football is given a restraining order as the World Cup kiss case reaches court.
Everyone saw the images. The whole country saw it. We can show that Mr. Rubiales lacked consent.
Also in this podcast, 30 years since the Oslo Accords failed to bring peace to the Middle East. And the supersizing Colombian artist Fernando Botero has died. So far, only a trickle of international aid is beginning to arrive in eastern Libya after the devastating floods in which thousands of people were killed. The political infighting between local officials in the city of Derna and the internationally recognised government in Tripoli is hampering the relief efforts. The United Nations says it's redeployed a team sent to assist in the aftermath of Morocco's earthquake to Libya to coordinate help for as many as 900,000 people affected by the floods. Our correspondent Anna Foster managed to reach Derna from where she sent this report.
Even by night, Derna's recovery teams don't sleep. As darkness falls, another body is carefully pulled from the ruins, wrapped and taken to a waiting ambulance. It's a scene that's now been repeated thousands of times.
I can't describe when you see people dead, and maybe when you see one or two, it's you can hold yourself, you know. But when you see maybe it's 500 people in one street, there's women, child, old people.
Two dams meant to protect the city were broken apart by the force of the water. The deluge carried everything away with it. This wave of death and destruction sealed the fate of thousands. And glimpses of the horror are still emerging. Here in Derna, people began to pray for God's mercy. When the torrent passed, some were able to escape. As the rain continued to fall, they headed to the rooftops, with few understanding the scale of the unfolding catastrophe. Down below, the force of the water swept away everything in its wake. Those who could sought safety on higher ground.
It's things like this that really show you the explosive power of the water that cascaded through this city. Things like cars that have been picked up and crushed all through these streets. There have been trees ripped from their roots, and you can see now this scar on the landscape where buildings once stood, people once lived, and there's nothing left.
Rescuers are still working here day and night. And perhaps improbably, almost a week after this disaster, there are still hopes of survival. Speak to us so we can find where you are, the team calls out. Turkish rescuers wade through the pools of destruction in search of what remains. The thick mud and dirt coats everything and makes the work slow and dangerous. The risk of disease is growing.
Our feelings towards the city is very difficult to describe, to be honest with you. We lost friends, relatives, and a big portion of Derna society.
People are returning to Derna, not to resume their lives, but to identify the dead. The bodies keep coming, laid out on city pavements in the hope they might be claimed. Eastern Libya has been hideously transformed. We travelled across a shattered landscape, Derna's distinctive mosque a lone survivor among the ravaged homes and smashed bridge that once stood here. In Al Bayda, Ahmad Al-Hawal says life as he knew it has ended.
It came from here. It completely washed away the valley. It hit the wall and destroyed everything around it.
Ahmad is one of more than 30,000 people desperate for shelter, food and water. Libya's eastern government failed to protect them from this disaster. Now, in their greatest hour of need, it's struggling to cope with the aftermath.
Anna Foster in Derna. President Emmanuel Macron says France's ambassador to Niger, Sylvain Ité, is being held hostage at the French embassy in Niamey. Mr. Macron accused the military junta, which seized power in July, of blocking food deliveries. The coup leaders gave the French ambassador 2 days to leave Niger in August, but the French government refused to comply. Paris has not recognised the new military regime. Ian McWilliam reports.
Mr. Macron told journalists that Ambassador Sylvain Ité was literally being held hostage in the French embassy in the capital Niamey. He said the military junta was blocking deliveries of food and would not allow the ambassador to go out, so he and other diplomatic staff were being forced to live off military rations. Mr. Macron said Paris would act in agreement with Mohamed Bazoum, the deposed president, who's still being detained in the country. Paris considers Mr. Bazoum the legitimate head of state. Niger's military leaders have also told France to withdraw its force of 1,500 soldiers who were there to combat a jihadist insurgency. President Macron has already said that any redeployment will be decided together with Mr. Bazoum.
Ian McWilliam. The former president of Spain's Football Federation, Luis Rubiales, has been given a restraining order by a judge preventing him from approaching Jenny Hermoso, the player he kissed when she and her teammates were celebrating Spain's victory in the Women's World Cup final. He appeared in a Madrid court following a criminal complaint of sexual assault and coercion. Mr. Rubiales denied the claims and insisted the kiss was consensual. Miss Hermoso's lawyer, Carla Val, spoke outside court.
We can stand up what we said from the start. It was a kiss without consent. Everyone saw the images, and we can say that precisely because of that, we can show that Mr. Rubiales lacked consent.
Meanwhile, the announcement of Spain's women's squad to play Sweden next Friday, their first match since winning the World Cup, has been delayed indefinitely. 39 players reaffirmed their boycott of the national team, claiming the resignation of the president and the sacking of the coach, Jorge Vilda, had not gone far enough. Semra Hunter, a women's football reporter based in Spain, gave us her assessment.
I think a lot of people are watching with a lot of attention and curiosity to see how this plays out, because it could bring about a monumental shift in wider society as well, if in fact he is found guilty and subsequently does face some very serious consequences. This, of course, comes as a result of a new law that was put into place last year. And it would be the first time in such a major scale that something like this could actually happen in terms of somebody found guilty of a crime as it relates to sexual aggression. But I think it's really interesting how this is all playing out, especially today as well. In parallel to all of this, there's other news going on as it relates to the women's Spanish national team. The 23 World Cup winners are going to continue to go on strike, that they are not going to heed the call of the new coach and that they're not going to come back until further structural changes are put into place. It's a very rapidly evolving situation here, and it does very much have the attention, I think, of not just the football fan here in Spain, but a lot of people across wider society as well, because there's so much linked between the culture and society as well as what's happening in the football realm.
Semra Hunter. It's taken nearly half a century, but a man who says he was tortured during the final months of General Franco's dictatorship has testified in court. Julio Pacheco was a left-wing activist when he was arrested. He says the matter is important to him even after all this time.
Whether there will be a trial or no trial, that I don't know. But yes, to have a trial and to see the torturers, those who tortured me, in the dock, for me, that would be the important thing.
His wife, Rosa Garcia, says she was also tortured. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt, told me more about the decades-old case.
It goes back to 1975. That's when Julio Pacheco was arrested along with Rosa Garcia, his now wife. This was months before General Francisco Franco died. He, of course, was the man who'd ruled Spain since the civil war of the late 1930s. And then 2 years after he died, the Spanish Parliament passed an amnesty which applied to opponents of the regime, but also, of course, to Franquist officials and officers. And that has been used basically to shield people from prosecution. So cases haven't gone anywhere. They've often been archived or just rejected completely. So Spain's search for justice actually in recent years has come closer to in Argentina, where some activists have filed cases and there's an ongoing investigation into genocide and crimes against humanity conducted from Argentina, which has its own history of dictatorship, on the principles of universal jurisdiction. Now, supporters of the victims of Franco in Spain argue that torture is a crime against humanity, and so that the amnesty from 1977 and the statute of limitations in Spain doesn't apply. But there's a tension here between domestic law and international law, and up to now, domestic law has always taken precedence. Julio Pacheco, he was arrested when he was 19. He's now a pensioner, so a lot of time has passed.
Where does this go from here?
Yeah, he was applauded by a small group of supporters outside the court when he and his wife came out. And he hopes that it opens a chink in the immunity that Franquist offenders had had for all this time and could set a precedent. The judge obviously has to rule on whether the case actually goes to trial. She will also summon the one living policeman who is alleged to have conducted the torture. And she'll also try to get documentation both from the National Archive and the police. There are about 100 cases that have been presented at the courts. Most of those have been archived automatically. And there have been five in more recent times since the law of historical memory was passed by the current socialist-led government. But this is the first one to actually come to court.
Danny Eberhardt. Security has been tightened in Iran ahead of the first anniversary on Saturday of the death of the Kurdish-Iranian woman Mahsa Amini, which triggered nationwide protests. The 22-year-old had been arrested for allegedly violating the dress code for women when she died in the custody of the morality police. After several months, the regime succeeded in crushing the protests, but not the widespread desire for change. The authorities have carried out waves of arrests over the past few weeks to prevent new unrest. But every day, young women are still carrying out daily acts of defiance, as Caroline Hawley reports.
A town in northern Iran last September as protests spread around the country. A brutal crackdown is underway against an uprising led by women furious at decades of repression, of being told what they should wear and how they should behave.
I've come to Italy, to the suburbs of Milan, to meet a young woman, a 33-year-old, who suffered horribly at the hands of the regime.
Elahe Tavlokian shows me video of the moment that changed her life. She'd never protested before, but felt compelled to after Mahsa Amini's death. As she was trying to help people injured while pulling down pictures of the supreme leader, she was shot herself.
The last moment I was with my children before I was shot, I had bought them school supplies. All their clothes and hands were covered with blood. And they kept shouting, "My mom was killed." It was a tough moment. I can never forget it.
In agony in hospital, she's asking, "Why is nobody treating me?" The doctor on call had said he wouldn't help protesters who'd been shot. Elahi managed to get out of the country, but surgeons in Italy couldn't save her right eye. The protests were the most serious challenge to Iran's theocratic regime since the revolution of 1979. They lasted for months, but were eventually crushed. With hundreds killed, thousands upon thousands imprisoned, and seven protesters executed. But every day, women are still quietly defying the regime, despite the risks.
I've been put in touch with two young women in Tehran who are both now going out without the hijab. Understandably, they're very, very scared to speak, so we talk on a messaging app and agree to delete the conversation immediately and also to change their voices.
I've had three warnings for not wearing the hijab. Text warnings. Because when you're driving, they record your number plate on CCTV.
I dress however I like now, but there are still some limits. Like, I can't wear a tank top or shorts when I go out.
How do you feel when you pass by the morality police with your head uncovered?
I couldn't have imagined that I could be this brave before Masa's death. Even though I feel scared to my bones, whenever I pass a morality police, I keep my head high and I pretend that nothing is happening.
At a protest last autumn, Mojgan İlhanlı, a 53-year-old filmmaker, is unveiled. Since then, she's regularly posted pictures of herself without the compulsory headscarf. And she spent months in jail for publicly criticising Iran's supreme leader.
What has changed after Mahsa's death is men's public opinion of women. In the streets, in the metro, in bazaars, they praise women's courage, even at family gatherings.
A Western diplomat in Tehran told me that on the streets of Iran, around 20% of women now go out without the hijab. The regime is fighting back, preparing a new law to penalise them, and making a wave of recent arrests to prevent new protests breaking out. But women activists insist that the social revolution now underway can't be reversed.
Caroline Hawley. Questions amounting surrounding the fate of the Chinese Defence Minister Li Shangfu, who has not been seen in public for several weeks. The US envoy to Japan, Rahm Emanuel, has raised concerns about his whereabouts amid growing media speculation that Mr. Li could be under house arrest. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton, told me more.
Well, Mr. Li is someone who's really had a pretty seamless career, rising smoothly through China's military ranks, also through the parallel ranks of the party, until he became defense minister in 2022. That's an important post, but the key thing is that he's also a state counselor, and there's only five of them in China. They sit at the very top of China's elaborate party government military structure, so it's a really important post. Now, the fact that Mr. Li disappeared from view for a few weeks isn't that big a deal, but it wasn't until China abruptly cancelled a visit Mr. Li was supposed to make to Vietnam without any explanation. That's when people really started being concerned and wondering what had happened to him. Now, the other thing is that the government hasn't really responded to questions about Li Shangfu's fate, and crucially, he hasn't been seen in public. Sometimes when questions are raised about a certain member of China's government or the party, they will quickly resurface in a very public way. Well, Mr. Li hasn't resurfaced, and that's why we're still talking about him now.
And this disappearance arguably is part of a pattern.
That's right. This probably sounds a bit familiar because just a few months ago, we were talking about the abrupt disappearance of another state counselor and the foreign minister, Qin Gang. Now, again, he had only been in his post for 7 months. When he abruptly disappeared, he has been replaced by his actual predecessor, then became his successor, Wang Yi. And we really don't know much about Qin Gang's fate either. And so this is all looking very fishy for China's leader, Xi Jinping, because both men are known to be very close to Mr. Xi. And if we go back to Li Shangfu, the defense minister, Li Shangfu was the head of military procurement before he became defense minister. And so questions are being raised as to whether Xi Jinping, the party underneath him, has uncovered some corruption that Mr. Li was involved in. Well, again, that doesn't look good for Xi Jinping, because this happened when Xi Jinping was in power. This really doesn't look good for China's top leader.
Celia Hatton. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
It's completely wild. I mean, it was at 190,000, which is a lot in itself. In the last 12 minutes, it just went into this absolute frenzy of bidding.
The sweater once worn by Princess Diana that sold at auction for a jaw-dropping sum. And Andrew Peach is here with details of this week's Happy Pod.
Yes, this week, the story of Moose, the dog who saved Sheila and Chris from a fire on their houseboat. They join me from Texas to tell the story, which they've also set to music. If you heard about the American caver who fell ill thousands of metres below ground in Turkey, cave rescuers from the whole world joined forces to work out how to get him out safely. I'll talk to the Croatian man who led the rescue effort. And if you're swimming 50 kilometres in the sea, how the biggest challenge comes from the jellyfish. I'll talk to Jonty, who took them on a few days ago. He's an amputee, by the way. Those stories and more in the Happy Pod, available to download in this feed every Saturday.
The social media app TikTok, which is owned by a Chinese company, has been fined nearly $370 million by the European Union for violating children's privacy. An investigation by Ireland's Data Protection Commission found their TikTok accounts were visible to all users. Helen Dixon is the head of the Irish-based Data Protection Commission.
What we discovered is that on registration, child users, so those aged 13 to 17, and indeed we found some under 13 on the platform, essentially had their accounts defaulted to public. And what that meant in this case is that then videos that they shared were accessible to anyone. That is precisely at the hands of TikTok because of the way they designed the platform. And we say, therefore, that that infringed the data protection by design and by default.
TikTok said that it disagreed with the decision and that it had dealt with most of the issues highlighted. I asked the BBC's technology reporter, Tom Gherkin, how important this fine was.
As a business, it might be quite significant. There's big tech companies that have been fined more. Meta's been fined more than $1 billion. Instagram was fined $400 million. But for TikTok, this far outstrips any fine they've faced before. In the UK, they faced a fine of around $14 million. Obviously, that number is quite substantially smaller than this, which is a whopping $370 million. I appreciate there's lots of different numbers being thrown at you there, but it does show you that in the context of all these fines going around from the Irish data regulator, and there are a lot of fines, this one might not be the biggest one, but it is still far bigger than anything TikTok has faced so far in its history.
Yeah, but TikTok has, what, a billion users? $370 million would be a lot of money to you and me, but is it really going to hurt? What's it going to mean in practice?
In the short term, perhaps not so much, but bear in mind that this is only part one of the investigation from the data regulator. It still is looking into TikTok and it's still raising questions on that very same topic that Meta faced the big fine on. That is the governing of people's data and being taken between different jurisdictions. If they've found them guilty of this, who knows what will happen with that? But certainly, this could just be part one of an even bigger fine on the horizon. So that will be a really big question mark for TikTok.
Tom Gherkin. In 1993, the international community felt positive that the Israelis and the Palestinians would by now be living in peace. This came with the Oslo Accords, which were signed 30 years ago this week and gave the Palestinians hope that they would get their own state. But these dreams have long since faded, as Yoland Nell reports from the occupied West Bank.
This is the Manara roundabout in the heart of Ramallah. The fountains are on here. This is an affluent Palestinian city that has become synonymous with the Palestinian Authority, the interim body that was set up following the signing of the Oslo Accords 3 decades ago. So what do people here in Ramallah think of the situation today?
I don't think fundamentally the rights and the conditions of Palestinian people have changed. It's been very disappointing.
No, wallah, ma'am, wallah, ishi.
Nothing has changed. Things are bad and getting worse.
The agreement we will sign reflects the decision we made in the Palestine Liberation Organization to turn a new page in our relationship with Israel.
Back in 1993, the first of two Oslo Accords was signed on the White House lawn. Palestinians believed these would soon lead to the creation of their own independent state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, with its capital in East Jerusalem. But Oslo is now widely seen as a disaster, says veteran Palestinian pollster Khalil Shikeki.
30 years ago, two-thirds of the public was highly optimistic. The support for Oslo was very high. Today, the belief that Oslo failed is overwhelming. The belief that the two-state solution is no longer viable is also overwhelming.
All around the edges of Ramallah, you see evidence of Israel's continuing grinding military occupation of the West Bank. I'm driving now through an Israeli checkpoint. There are settlements. These have expanded sixfold in the past 30 years. They're seen as illegal under international law, but Israel disagrees. Nevertheless, a former Palestinian Authority minister, Sabri Saidem, insists there have been Palestinian gains from Oslo.
the establishment of the different institutions, the consolidation of the Palestinian identity, the reinforcement of the law and order under the Palestinian Authority, the salary payments. It reflects an achievement which Palestinians would like to preserve.
Here in Ramallah, I'm surrounded by Palestinian Authority schools, government ministries. The authorities survived the collapse of peace talks with Israel and the violence of the second Palestinian uprising. Also, the damaging internal split after the Islamist militant group Hamas won the last elections in 2006 and went on to take full control of Gaza. Many Palestinians now see the authority as corrupt, repressive. Diana Boutou, a former Palestine Liberation Organization spokeswoman, questions why it still exists.
We're now looking at a situation where if you're under the age of 35, you've never voted in any elections for the Palestinian Authority. It's the opposite of self-determination and self-government. It's become a dictatorship and rule by those who are unelected with no real purpose, no real connection to any political process.
Another funeral. This has been the bloodiest year in years for Palestinians and Israelis in the West Bank. And with a new hardline government in Israel, the prospects for peace look even bleaker. And yet everyone I've met here in Ramallah still dreams of it. It's just that with Oslo's failure, there's a shortage of new ideas on how to end the decades-old conflict and little faith in the Palestinian leadership.
Yoland Nell. The former US ambassador to Pakistan and the United Arab Emirates has avoided a prison sentence after admitting to criminal charges. Richard G. Olson confessed to illicitly lobbying US officials on behalf of the Qatari government within a year of leaving office. He also failed to declare an $18,000 first-class plane ticket to attend a job interview with a Gulf investment firm in London while he was still serving. He's been sentenced to 3 years probation for each offence and ordered to pay $93,400. From Washington, here's Sean Dilley.
Richard Olson was once described by the US Secretary of State as quite simply one of our most distinguished diplomats. Now, though, his reputation lies in ruins. Prosecutors say the crimes he admitted formed part of a pattern of unethical behaviour. Beyond his convictions, in 2012, Olson started seeing a TV journalist in Islamabad. In 2014, they split after she found out he'd been cheating on her and his wife. Months later, he introduced her to a Pakistani-American businessman who paid $25,000 towards her university fees and arranged a further $50,000 loan. While serving as head of consulate in Dubai, Olson failed to declare $60,000 of diamonds delivered to him on behalf of the country's leader, claiming they had been a gift for his now late mother-in-law.
Sean Dilley. A knitted sweater once owned and worn by Princess Diana has sold at auction in New York for more than $1 million. The red woolen jumper is covered by white sheep, with one exception. There's also a single black sheep. The auctioneers Sotheby's had estimated the value at $50,000 to $90,000. Frenzied bidding meant that this was a record price for an item of clothing worn by the British royal. Joanna Osborne is one of the original designers of the jumper, and she's been speaking to Tim Franks.
There's been a lot of speculation as to where the original sheep jumper that was damaged by Princess Diana, where it was. And we assumed that we'd lost it in the midst of time or accidentally sold it by mistake, just because we were a sort of young business desperate to complete orders. But I was up in the attic looking through 2,000 old patterns for a pattern that somebody had requested. And I just happened to see an old wine box. And I opened it and there was this rolled up sheep jumper, not kept in any kind of special way. And then I suddenly had this distant memory that actually maybe it was one that Diana had worn.
And the reason it had come back to you was because, as you say, and this is a key bit, isn't it, that it was damaged.
It was damaged. So she wore it for the first time before she was married to Prince Charles. And we had no idea she had it. We think it was given to her by one of her friends. And then Buckingham Palace wrote to us that she had damaged the jumper and could we either replace it or repair it? Well, of course, we immediately replaced it. And in fact, when we sold the jumper yesterday, it went with the two letters from Buckingham Palace too.
Because that proves that that was the jumper that was worn. This isn't just some other jumper that's been potentially knocked up.
Yes, it doesn't prove conclusively. We absolutely definitely knew. And also, they were all made individually in those days, and all their eyes were sewn onto each sheep. So depending on the placement of an eye on a particular row of sheep, then we just knew. I mean, it was definitely the right one, and they also agreed.
But then, my goodness me, $1 million.
I know.
It's bonkers, isn't it?
It's completely wild. I mean, it was at 190,000, which is a lot in itself for hours and hours. It was only in the last 12 minutes that it just went into this absolute frenzy of bidding.
I'm not in any way denigrating your obviously very catchy, memorable design here, but it is just amazing that this sort of Diana memorabilia, it really commands such intense interest even now.
I know, but she is even more famous and revered now than she was when she was alive. When she wore that jumper, she was an important part of the royal family life, but now, partly because she died so young, partly because the royal family is constantly evolving, partly because she made the royal family evolve, people just can't get enough information about her.
Designer Joanna Osborne. The Colombian painter and sculptor Fernando Botero has died. He was 91 and his subjects were often rotund people. His objects had epic proportions. Richard Collings has this report.
While originally training to be a bullfighter, Botero took to painting the action from the sidelines instead. And the travails of the bull ring continued to figure in every decade of his work, as did depictions of large ladies and men and larger-than-life fruit such as apples and oranges. One of his most famous works was a copy of Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa with a puffed-up, voluminous face. There's something almost comforting about his images that make you feel you want to fall into their arms, even though they might be convicted criminals. Most of Botero's childhood in the 1930s was spent in what was to become, half a century later, one of Colombia's most embattled cities, Medellin, famous for the drugs trade and cartel supremo Pablo Escobar. He painted Escobar twice, but claimed never to have met him. But his paintings did circulate among cartel leaders, something which helped elevate their price. He came in for some heavy criticism when one appeared to show Escobar expertly dodging bullets on a tiled roof. It's still displayed in a Medellin gallery and hangs controversially alongside Botero's take on Jesus.
Some people have criticized me because I did this painting. But, you know, it's not that you admire somebody by the fact that you do the painting. You know, I always said, for instance, Al Capone. The Americans did a lot of films and books and things about Al Capone. It doesn't mean that they admire Al Capone, but, you know, it was part of the history.
His monumental portraits showing the U.S. Army's torture of inmates at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq are his most memorable internationally acclaimed work. He produced over 80 of them, some measuring more than 4 meters high, and dared to exhibit them on former U.S. President George Bush's doorstep at an exhibition close to the White House in Washington. In the last 5 years of his life, Fernando Botero entered the elite list of the top 10 of the world's most commercially successful artists, with bronze sculptures selling for around $2 million apiece. But in his lifetime, Botero didn't receive the critical claim he believed he deserved, although he did become a national icon in Colombia, was very popular among collectors in Japan and mainland Europe, and died an extremely wealthy man.
Richard Collings, who actually spent a year following Fernando Botero around South America. And that's all from us for now. But there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast at the same time tomorrow. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.